Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Known for her incredible research, best-selling author Jodi Picou brings to life the incomparable Amelia Bassano, the real-life and too-little-considered English poet believed to have authored many of Shakespeare's plays and sonnets. Told in intertwining storylines and rooted in primary historical sources, Picou's latest is By Any Other Name. The bias against female artists both historically and today is illuminated in the novel. Jodi Picou is the number one New York Times bestselling author of 29 books, including titles such as Mad Honey, Wish You Were Here, A Spark of Light, and Small Great Things. It is always a pleasure to welcome Jodi Picou to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you back on the program.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
What brought you to Shakespeare? And I don't think I'm telling anything, but it seems like maybe you have a bit of an axe to grind.
Well, I don't know that I have an axe to grind. I mean, I was an English major when I went to college, and I fell in love with Shakespeare's writing or his works, in particular, the proto-feminist characters, you know, Beatrice, Rosalind, Portia, Kate. I love the complexity and the three-dimensionality of those women, because for the time that was pretty remarkable. And maybe a professor said to me at one point for 5 minutes, oh, you know, there's a question about the authorship of Shakespeare's works, that he may not have written his works himself. And like everyone else, I kind of went, ha ha, what a silly joke, you know, and just totally forgot about it. And then a few years ago, I was reading an article in The Atlantic by Elizabeth Winkler called Was Shakespeare a Woman? In which she looked at the authorship question. And one of her statements just like literally stopped me in my tracks. And it was that Shakespeare had two daughters that survived infanthood, and he never taught either of them to read or write. They signed with a mark. And I went, whoa, 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 whoa. The guy who created those characters would have taught his girls how to read. And I just didn't buy it. And I wound up doing a very deep dive into Amelia Bassano, who I had never heard of before, but who Elizabeth talked about in her book. And I started to read as much as I could and learn as much as I could about her life. And to my great surprise, the gaps in Shakespeare's life that academics have spent literally hundreds of years trying to explain away are seamlessly filled by Amelia's life.
So let's get to some of those gaps in a moment. But before we do, the idea that once you come across this, that this is something that you want to investigate in such a deep manner, further complicated by the fact by there's really very little out there about Amelia Bassano.
Absolutely. That is 100% true. And I'm no stranger to research, but yes, it was challenging to fill in the sort of the parameters of her life that I then would work between. To answer the first part of your statement, you know, this was something that I was so drawn to. In many ways, I feel like this is the book that I was meant to write my entire life. I have spent so many years talking about gender discrimination in publishing and how women are repeatedly judged in ways that men never are. Even as a successful author, if someone hears that you're a writer and you're a female, they say, oh, do you write romance? Do you write children's books? Do you write women's fiction? What is even women's fiction? Where's men's fiction? What's that? These are issues I've kind of tackled and grappled with my whole life. And that sense that a woman wasn't getting the credit she was due was something that felt very personal to me, which is why I wanted to dive into this so deeply. What we do know about Amelia, we know mostly from the diaries of a man named Simon Forman. Simon Forman was kind of a hack of a doctor slash astrologer. And Amelia went to him after she had several miscarriages and she wanted to have another child. He spent most of their sessions trying to sleep with her. She rejected him, and he documented all of that too. But also in those diaries are all of the details that we know about her life. She and her family came from Italy. They were incredible musicians. They were the recorder consort to King Henry VIII and then to Queen Elizabeth I, which is how they got over to England. They were Jewish, but had to hide their faith. When Amelia was seven and her father died, she became the ward of a countess. Very surprisingly for the time, insisted on giving Amelia a full classical and legal education. When she got remarried, Amelia was 12 years old. She was kind of in limbo for a while, and Amelia wound up living with her brother, Peregrine Barty, who was the ambassador to Denmark, and who, the year that Amelia was living with him, went on a diplomatic mission to meet the king and the queen, also had a state dinner with an astronomer named Tycho Brahe, whose supernova starts Hamlet, and Tycho Brahe's relatives, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Again, this is also a place Shakespeare we know never visited. And then she wound up at age 13 becoming the mistress to the Lord Chamberlain of England. He was 56 years old, and he was in charge of all theater in England. So any play that was written crossed his desk for censorship. He was at rehearsals, he was at opening nights. She would have met every single player in the theater world while she was with this man for 10 years. When she was 23, she got pregnant. You couldn't have a mistress who was pregnant when you were already married. So he threw her out by marrying her off to her wastrel of a cousin who blew through all the money that was settled on her to keep her comfortable. And all of a sudden, Amelia's 23 years old, has a baby, a husband she hates, and she needs money. What we also know is that years later, in 1611, she was the first published female poet in all of England, which is a tremendous achievement in her own right, whether or not you think she had anything to do with the Shakespearean plays. But writers don't show up in their late 40s out of nowhere. It's my belief that she was writing. She just wasn't using her own name to do it.
That book is, as you indicate in the novel, was not successful. And you question in the novel of why that was the case. Women weren't reading women, men weren't reading her, or it just wasn't getting the attention that it should get in the way it was published.
That's a great question, and the answer is a little of all of that. She was appealing to multiple patronesses, hoping that they were going to basically become her monetary source. Not a single one of them took her up basically on the offer, in spite of the
Right.
lovely prose she wrote about them. But this was a book called Salve Deus Rex Judorum that was very proto-feminist in its leanings. It suggested that the only people who really helped Christ were the women. There's a poem in it called A Defense of Eve, in which basically Amelia says, look, if men are so much better than women, then how come when Eve offers Adam the apple, he doesn't just go, yeah, not hungry, I'm cool. That was shocking at the time. So I think that probably men did not want their wives reading that. Why would they want to incite rebellion in their own households? And I think for all of those reasons, it didn't sell. I also think that Amelia had to be careful to not reveal herself as the author of the plays. And for that reason, the actual technical skill of her book is very different than what's in the plays. It's the same subject matter. It's still very proto-feminist. It's still edgy, kind of skating on the edge of treason. But I think she dumbed down her writing.
In the historical research that you did you find this woman, the real life woman, to be as, let's say, pointed as your character is in calling out some of these inequities?
I mean, I'm still working within a framework of very, very few primary historical sources. But
Right.
we know from even the way that she's documented in those diaries that she was fiery, that she was spirited. She was very aware of the fact that she lived a life where she had money and jewels and people paying attention to her, even though she wasn't living that life now. Because after she was cast out of the home of the Lord Chamberlain, she was no longer a member of court. She was never going to be a noble. So I do think that there's definitely a sense that she has a mind and a spirit that I think a lot of women were not able to show back then, which of course is the impetus I think for her paying a man for the use of his name, and that man being William Shakespeare. As a woman, she never would have been able to get her own work in front of the public.
Jodi Picou is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is By Any Other Name. It is published by Ballantine. We have Melina Green, who is a young playwright. This is modern day New York City. You start off with that vantage point. She finds out that she is an ancestor, Amelia Bassano. Suddenly it takes over because these two roads of her life intersect. She is a playwright, a woman who is trying to make a living in a post-COVID theater world. Good luck. And then also, there's this whole background that she suddenly looks into and says, oh, okay, so these are things that I can write about, and this will be my subject.
I should say that although Amelia is a real life figure, Melina is someone I made up. Although I have had
Right.
actual descendants of the real Amelia reach out to me, which is kind of cool. She is a woman, as you said, who is trying to make a go of it in theater and is being told all things that I myself have heard. One of the great kind of twists of my own life is that I wound up writing librettos for musical theater, started about 10 years ago. Everything Melina is told in this book about her play, about Amelia Bassano, is something I was told to my face about the first show I worked on, which was an adaptation of one of my novels called Between the Lines. I was told, because it was the story of a young girl, that it was too small, that it was too emotional. It was theater for young kids. It wasn't adult theater. It wouldn't sell tickets. All of these things are things that I wanted Melina to hear as well, because that is what it means to be a working female playwright right now. You are still at the mercy of the gatekeepers, who tend to be a lot of old white men who want to put on their stages and the theaters they own stories that reflect their own upbringing and their own sensibilities. That means that a lot of stories about women are not being told. A lot of stories about people who are not old white men are not being told. You don't just have to be a woman. There are lots of marginalized groups that aren't getting to have their voices on stage. It was kind of a meeting of all the worlds to write this book for me. I have worked in the theater world. I have worked in the publishing world. I know what it's like to be a female storyteller. I know what it's like to be judged differently than men in my field. In many ways, that's why this book became so incredibly personal.
Are both those fields, whether it be theater or publishing, are they both equally sexist or sexist in their own separate ways?
Oh, they're sexist in their own separate ways, you know? And I mean, I should say how I'm lucky I am to even be able to play in these sandboxes, right? And I am really, really glad to. Writing for theater completely invigorated my love of writing novels and vice versa. But I was really surprised, you know, when you know that 80% of tickets on Broadway are being purchased by women,
Right.
but the number of actual female creatives is still way less than 50%. And we know that because people are actively crunching numbers. There was a count that came out a few days ago called Women Count. You know, there's still an inequity there. In publishing, what you see looks very equitable at first sight. You know, you got a lot of, obviously, a lot of women authors now, a lot of female readers. You have a lot of female editors. You have a lot of female agents. But it's again that top strata. Who is running the publishing companies? Who's at the very, very top? Not too many women.
There is a point in the novel where the question is asked, name five women playwrights, and they come up with four, and I think they use Susan Laurie Parks twice, right? So it's interesting because it so proves the point.
It does. One of the things that we used to do when we were working on Between the Lines, it was very important to us to show a realistic mother-daughter relationship on stage. And we used to say to people, name five musicals with a realistic mother-daughter storyline at its heart. And you're like, Mamma Mia, well, that's not really realistic. Gypsy, certainly not healthy. And you really can't do it. It's hard. You know, but there's a reason that we struggle to find those in a canon. And it's because women's stories have not been part of the canon, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be. One of the things I kept coming back to when I was doing the historical research about Amelia was that, in spite of the fact that there aren't a lot of primary sources, that didn't mean that women weren't active and writing at the time. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence when it comes to this.
I was pleased to see the name Teresa Ribick in your novel several times. An outstanding, amazing woman and playwright. She does a lot of work here in Dorset, Vermont, and around the country. Is just so thoughtful on these very issues. And you thank her in the author's note. And I would think that people like her would have been very helpful in this of obviously you have your own experience, but to also know what else is out there of someone who's making their living off this.
Absolutely. Teresa is someone that I spoke to at length. There is a young playwright, Natalie Margolin, who I've spoken with about what it's like to be Melina's age and facing this. Kristen Anderson Lopez, who writes in the musical field, is someone who has been very outspoken about gender issues in theater. And sometimes that has been difficult in terms of her getting a reputation for being, you know, combative, when really all she's doing is speaking the truth.
Then in the novel, you introduce us to Melina's gay best friend, who is also African American, and he's trying to get his stuff published too, but he makes a decision to take one of Melina's plays out of her hands and submits it to a festival under a pseudonym, and then, you know, then all hell breaks loose. But what it brings us to is this real dilemma of the stories that are being told. Who is telling them? Why are they being told? And then this pecking order, if you will, of which is more woke for the moment, a story by a woman playwright or of a black playwright. And because, my God, we can only do one. Again, post-COVID world where we were coming to some awakening. And in that awakening, we just sort of screwed it up because it wasn't a matter of, oh, well, we're going to open this up and we're going to have diversity, equity, and inclusion. We're just going to have diversity, equity, inclusion in one theater.
In one space, right?
In one space.
It was really fun to sort of dive into that because I don't think anyone is really talking about this yet, at least not out loud. But you're right, there was a reckoning in the theater world after COVID, and particularly after George Floyd's murder, where a lot of these white male theater owners were like, oh, shoot, we better do something. And the way that they decided to do something was to take one slot in their theater, one slot in their season, and most of the time give it to a black male playwright, sometimes black females, but mostly black male. Again, let's talk about how great that was. We saw things on Broadway that we never would see, and they were extraordinary. I mean, A Strange Loop was a phenomenal show that I am absolutely not the target demographic for, and yet I absolutely adored it. And I was thrilled to be able to see something like that on Broadway because we don't get to see those stories most of the time. But the fallacy, as you said, is in assuming that there's one slot, there's one seat that can be ceded to someone who is in a marginalized group. It's really hard to be an ally when you still feel like you're being passed over, right? I mean, because jealousy is a very normal human emotion. Part of Melina's struggle and journey is in recognizing that she's so concentrated and focused on her own inability to break through that ceiling that it has made her blind to the same feelings that her best friend is having as well. And that question of how do you advocate for yourself but manage to be an ally for others is a very nuanced one and a very difficult one. And of course, the answer is the simplest thing of all. Make a bigger table, make more spots, make more seats.
Right.
You know, but that is not something that is in the vernacular right now.
You make another statement in the book, which I think is interesting too, is that even what was offered us in a very limited way. It would be for 2 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever. It wasn't, they weren't going to give it a full run just because it was being done by a woman. It's almost the same thing today, or it is the same thing today within the theater of not giving it the full treatment.
Right. And you see that. I mean, very often in theater, what you will see is someone take a risk on a young male playwright the way they won't do it on a young female playwright. They'll say, but what has she done? Like, you have to prove yourself before you get that chance. And like you said, very astutely, the same is true for Amelia's book. When she went to publish, she actually had more prefaces to these poems, to all these, you know, patronesses that she hoped were going to shower money on her. She had so many of them, more than any other book had. And her publisher kept wanting her to cut it down because it was a printing cost. It was going to cost him more and it was going to be more risky. And he wasn't willing to take that chance.
So in the novel, Amelia wants to have a play. And so she comes up with this plan to bring the play of hers to the stage by paying an actor by the name of William Shakespeare to front the work. And well, again, I started off by saying this, but William doesn't come off great in all in any of this, does he? And correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like you wanted to try.
Okay, let me tell you what we know about Shakespeare. Again, there are limited facts. We all have the same facts we're working from. Here's what we know about the guy. He was a businessman, he was a producer, and he was an actor. We know that he evaded taxes twice. We know that he had multiple restraining orders taken out against him by colleagues. We know that when there was a famine, he hoarded grain and jacked up the price for his neighbors. So these are the facts we have about the guy. He's
Yeah.
not exactly, the canonized bard that he has become. We also know that he wasn't educated at university. He was apparently self-taught, but when he died, he did not own a single book. We know that he never left the country, but he managed to write about places like Egypt and Denmark and Italy in details that weren't even available in guidebooks at the time. We know that he never played a musical instrument, but there are more than 3,000 references to music in his plays. Like, there are all these things that we actually know about Shakespeare. Here's what we do not know: that he wrote anything that has the name William Shakespeare on it. And I'm far from the first person to suggest that maybe he had a little help. In the real world, I think Amelia was probably not the only person who was using his name. I think there were multiple people using it, and I do allude to that a little bit in the book.
You do. I mean,
Yes.
as Melina is looking at the folio, these are all of the names of people that have probably either have completely written or certainly contributed to the work.
For many years, the Earl of Oxford has kind of been floated as an author. I think he probably ran a stable of authors, kind of like James Patterson does today. And I think he used, William Shakespeare's name. And I actually think that in the theater world, people knew a Shakespeare play had quotes around it, that it was like, it wasn't really written by Shakespeare. And I think that's one of the reasons why when Shakespeare died, that name was the most recognizable playwright of the time. Not a single other playwright wrote any kind of posthumous oratory or, praise of him or lament on his death. Doesn't that feel a
Yeah,
little weird?
it is weird, and you bring it up a couple of times in the novel and also the Pride of England, who isn't buried in Westminster Abbey in the Poet's Corner.
Right, and there are people, believe me, you've never heard of who got in there. So,
Yeah.
Shakespeare was really everything that he was at the time. I mean, he was by far the best known playwright of the time, and his plays cost more to go see. I mean, he definitely had a reputation. So it just doesn't add up correctly. And I think it was a joke, and I think we lost the punchline.
I have never read a novel that had as many
I know what you're
that
gonna say.
has the sourcing, the author's note and the sourcing in it, and acknowledgments and the Shakespearean references. But God bless you. These are just wonderful because there are Easter eggs in there, and this helps us in that, helps us brush up on our Shakespeare, as it were. But one of the things that you say in the author's note that really stuck with me, and I, having been a public radio talk show host for a long time, I know what ticks off our listeners. And you point out that you have written books on every controversial subject you can possibly imagine, and you are just bracing for the hell storm that this is going to cause.
Can I tell you something? The book isn't even technically published yet, and already I have academics saying I'm insane, I'm a conspiracy theorist, lobbing everything at me. I am blown away. I had people writing entire posts and publishing them in papers in England, and I think it's remarkable that people can be so upset about a book they haven't even had a chance to read yet. But I knew this was going to happen because Shakespeare is not just a writer. Shakespeare is a mythology. Shakespeare has been canonized in many ways. And to cast doubt on Shakespeare is to unravel the life's work of many academics, who have spent quite a lot of time on his plays and and on their love of his writing. I take away none of that. I'm not going to tell you to think what I think. You could think whatever you want. And I will say too that I too love the writing. I love those plays. I just want to make sure we're giving credit where credit's due.
Speaking of loving the writing, your writing in this book is just stupendous. And
You.
I will say that in reading a lot of novels, because it's my job, that you read a lot of novels that go back, that are intertwined, that go back and forth between different characters, different times. And I always find, as a reader, I have a favorite.
Yeah.
And then you, so you read it, and then you can't wait to get back to Colleen, and then we'll find out what's going on. I didn't feel that way with this. That dawned on me about two-thirds of the way through. Like, this is great, because normally I'm just thumbing ahead,
Yeah.
trying to, oh, let's find out what happens. But that's not the case here, because you so beautifully layer it.
Oh, thank you. I have never written a book the way I wrote this book. I always read it the way you talk about it. I write one chapter in one voice and then I write the next chapter in a different voice. But it was so hard keeping the world of Elizabethan England spinning in my head and all the details and facts that I had for Amelia that I wound up writing her whole section first and then all of Melina's modern section and then cutting and pasting them and, making sure that they fit where I needed them to. I have to say that at one point, I remember my husband who read the Amelia section said, "Why don't you just publish this as a historical novel?" And I could, but I didn't want to because part of the message here is that it's been 400 years and so much has not changed for women. And Melina's story really casts that into much greater relief.
Well, it is just an absolutely delightful read. The name of the new novel is By Any Other Name. It is published by Ballantine. Jody, thank you so much for spending time with us. It is an absolute delight. And I thank you so much for the beautiful work, and I thank you so much for the wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much. Be well.
Thanks.
Jodi Picoult's new novel is By Any Other Name, and is published by Ballantine Books. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.